Welcome to Desert Island Trek. Each week, we ask our guests to pick 8 items from Star Trek episodes, movies, and soundtracks to take with them to a desert island.
This week, our guest is Michael Adam Goodwill from Trekking Up North, a man from Redcar in the northeast of England who describes himself as being a passionate Trekkie, martini connoisseur, and a podcaster. Michael Adam, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
And of course, I've made a very bad mistake here. I forgot to introduce our co-host, Mike Overton. So, Mike, you're going to have to fade in as the third person in this episode. So I'm really sorry about that. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here, as always.
Mike, I'll let you go with the first question.
So, Mr. Goodwill, how did you first get into Star Trek?
Well, Mike 1, as we already established in previous episodes, you are Mike 1 and I will be Mike 2.
Exactly.
How did I get into Star Trek? It was the wee old age of 2 that I got into Star Trek. My grandmother and my mother were both Star Trek fans, loved the original series, loved the movies. And this is possibly my earliest memory that I still remember. I was 2 years old and it was when the original series was on BBC Two at six in the evening. And my mother plonked me down because I was a terrible twos and she was like, watch this. And I watched it and it was a time travel episode. I believe it was Gary Seven.
Ah.
And all I remember is bright colors, pointy eared man, a cat and a rocket. And from then on in, apparently, I just fell in love with it. And every day for about a year, I asked my mum, is Star Twix on? It was never Star Trek. It was Star Twix. So I can never look at a Twix without going, beam me up. And from then on in, that was it. I was a Trekkie. And I cannot remember a time in my entire life that I was never a Trekkie. It's blended into my DNA. If I take a blood sample, there's Ketracel White in it now. It's crazy. So yeah, all those years ago, that would be 33 years ago now.
And was there ever any point where you fell out of love with it?
Yes. Two occasions. Let's just have a sip of martini before I get into this, because there will be some controversy.
Oh dear.
So it was two occasions. It was Star Trek Into Darkness, because that was The Wrath of Khan, poorly remade. And controversially, Season 3 of Discovery. Ooh. Season 3 of Discovery is one of only two times in Star Trek, recent Star Trek, where I have shouted at the television. And it was the season finale. Was it the season finale or the episode before where we found out what caused the burn?
Yep.
And I just went, oh, come on! And that is honestly the one of the only two. I mean, the second time was the cliffhanger for season 2 of Strange New Worlds. And that was just like, oh my God, you can't. But yeah, so it was only those two times that I'd really fell out of love with Star Trek. And the first time really scored me because, yes, the Kelvinverse films are different. All Trek is good Trek. Let's not forget that. All Trek is good Trek, because at the end of the day, we could have no Star Trek at all. But this was sort of like, you have this young, dynamic crew. Yes, they're the original series crew, but they're young and dynamic. You could go your own way in this own universe with your own stories. You didn't even make it subtle what you were doing. It was just so ham-fisted and unnecessary that it just took me out of it. And I'm like, all the way through, I was like, please don't let Benefit Cumberbatch. Bendy Bus Cabbage Patch. Please don't let him be Khan. Please don't let him be Khan. And then he was like, I am Khan. And I'm like, he is so good at portraying any villain. Why does it have to be Khan? Yeah, why does it have to be Khan? He could have been an augment. He could have been this, you know, this genetically superior genius other than Khan. But they just shoehorned it in and it really took it out of me. So that and season 3 of Discovery, those are the only two times. But I have stuck with Discovery, and I will stick with Discovery right until the end, because like I keep saying, all Trek is good Trek.
Good man. So, you are stuck on a desert island. What is the first Trek thing you bring with you?
The first Trek thing I bring with me. It would be... The first Trek thing. Sorry, can we cut there? Is it the top eight items?
Yes. The list you gave us, yeah.
My mistake, sorry.
And action.
So the first thing I would bring would be the best copy of Star Trek First Contact you could absolutely buy right now. 8K, 16K, I don't care. The best copy of Star Trek First Contact, because that is my favorite Star Trek film of all time.
It is. When did you first see it?
1997, when it came out in the UK. It was the first film my parents took me to see at the cinema, was Star Trek First Contact. And it was also the first film to scar me for life, with the intro where a drill goes into Picard's eyeball. So I'm like, this is a good experience. Why do people do this? But it was, obviously I was 9 years old at the time, heavy Star Trek fan, and it just blew me away, because this was a darker, more well-performed, acted Star Trek that I'd ever seen before. The Borg were terrifying again. The special effects were amazing. We had the absolutely amazing score by Jerry Goldsmith.
Yep.
Which was, it to this day, is very emotional to me. And we just got to see an alcoholic break the light speed barrier in a half converted nuclear missile. And I'm like, that's the most American thing that could possibly be put onto screen. Do you know what I mean? who needs Elon Musk when you've just got an alcoholic in Montana who's going, I'll put a warp engine in that and to just be successful.
But so was it a case, Michael, it wasn't just, say, your love of Star Trek, but was it a kind of the fact that you went to see it with your parents as well, the first time that you would have seen a Star Trek movie in the cinema with them?
Yes, it was quite a... We never really had money growing up, and this was at a point where we had some money, so we could go and do these things. We could go on days out and stuff, and going to the cinema, you know, it's expensive today, but even back then, when you're... you know, in the north of England that was decimated in the 80s, it's like, oh, we're going to the cinema, this is a treat. And you go to see this film that's just packed with battles and terrifying cybernetic organisms. And it's just like, it's right in front of you. And like, admittedly, we did sit a little bit too close. So I'm like, looking like that. It was, yeah, and I fondly remember it. It was a wonderful experience. It was only me, my mother and my grandmother when I was growing up. So it was a very symbolic moment for me. But overall, the film itself, it's just, it hits every note right. It's got just enough space battles, just enough emotional dialogue, just enough Borg, fully functional, programmed in multiple techniques, which I didn't get until I was older. It was just amazing. And this was like a new angle, because obviously if you don't have Sky in the UK in the 90s, DS9 was like years behind where it was. So you're looking at DS9 where they've got all the little round TNG badges and stuff. And then this comes on and everything's darker and everything's got red leather and padded shoulder pads and stuff. And you look at it like, this is kick-ass Star Trek and I love it. And that whole era, even to this day, the whole era, that First Contact era, as it's called, that is like my home. That is what I associate with Star Trek more than anything. So yeah, that's
also just that shot of the Enterprise E. just that shot. Seeing that in the cinema for the first time, that hits.
Say what you want about John Eaves, right? That man can build a starship and just absolute chef's kiss. And when that ship was refitting Nemesis, I was like, he's done this, he's done this, he's done this. And everyone's like, it's the same ship. And I'm like, it's not. The pylons are ever so higher. There's a torpedo tube on that docking. I see the differences. But it was that shot when it's coming out of the nebula was beautiful. The humor in this though as well, where you've just got Riker deliberately trying to pay off Worf, where he's just like, tough little ship. Little.
But it's also the fact that they carry that on.
Yes.
Even today, they still carry that on, which I love.
Season 3 of Picard, that was just amazing. It's just so funny that it's obvious it stemmed from this like inherent jealousy that both had, because both were intimate with Deanna Troi. And it's sort of like that rivalry there where it's like, come on, Will, she's married to you. You've had two kids. No, he's still a dick.
Well, it's not like they could have used the Enterprise E.
Well, we don't discuss what happened to the Enterprise, do we? No.
Michael, you've kind of answered this potentially already, but if you had to pick an era of Star Trek or a starship or a starbase to live on or in that era, what would it be?
Ooh. Now, you see, if I've had a good think about this. It would be the TNG era, and it would be before or after the Dominion War. This is what I've been wrestling with, because TNG era before the Dominion War, there was still innocence, there was exploration, there'd never been a huge major conflict since the Klingon War. And it was that era, like they call the original series the Golden Era in the Star Trek universe. This was like the TNG era was technically the second golden era of exploration in terms of science, space, and everything like that. For me though, It would be one of two. It would either be the Enterprise D during the TNG era to live on, or really, if it was just to live and not command or anything like that, it would probably just be Deep Space Nine. Because I think Deep Space Nine, watching Deep Space Nine for the first time, and just, it was a family. It was a home. It was like Little House on the Prairie in space. It was just, they couldn't escape the problems, they were there, so they dealt with them week by week, and it felt like home. And I know Graham, my co-host on Trekking Up North, says this a lot. It's like, that's his comfort show. That's like, he will turn that on and he will feel at home, because DS9 is his home. And I have to agree with him, because they weren't just crew members, they were a family, and even more of a family than the Next Generation crew, I dare say.
I think it's one of those things, isn't it, that like one of the things about Star Trek that non-Star Trek fans don't really understand is that for Star Trek fans, the characters transcend the screen and they become kind of more than just actors. They become like your friend.
I said this a lot on another show. I didn't have much family when I was growing up. I had my mother and I had my grandmother. That was it. No siblings, no nothing. For me, the crew of the Enterprise D, Deep Space Nine, they were a second family. And for the longest time, although I was a huge Star Trek fan, and when I was a kid, I'd wear the comm badge to school and everything like that, I would never actually open up about my love of Star Trek, because it was something very personal to me, very intimate to me. And it's like, I don't want to share that with anyone. And it took the longest time. And I mean, I'm talking 2012, I think, at my first convention at Destination Star Trek, where I was like, oh, there's actually other people that feel the same way that I feel. And they are passionate about this. And they understand that these are just like additional people to your family. They are extra family or whatever you want to call it. And it summed up well, and as daft as it is, there was a on one of the VHS copies, I think it was actually Generations or First Contact, with where it was around about the 30th anniversary of Star Trek, and they'd brought out the the original movie VHS box set, and they did a little trailer for it on the VHS, and they're like, they have been our guys, they have been with us for 30 years, they are our family. And I'm like, And that's when I realized, like, when as a kid, I was like, yeah, that like I can see them as part of my family, because you grew up with these people. You saw all their adventures. You mourned when, spoiler alert, certain people died, and then got brought back to life. But then when the actors themselves pass away, like when DeForest Kelly passed away in 99, I mourned. I was a kid, but I'd still mourned. And when Leonard Nimoy passed away in 2015, I believe, I was broken. I was absolutely broken by it, because you grew up with these people, and I don't know what I'm going to be like when you know it's coming, but when the next generation crew, when people from the next generation crew start to pass away, I'll be like, no.
I dread the day Patrick Stewart passes away.
I will not, I'll be inconsolable. Because
I would literally book that week off work. I think.
But people who don't understand or are not major fans of certain things, don't understand how deeply it can affect people like that. They're like, but you've never met them. I don't have to meet someone to appreciate them or love them for what they have done and what they have given me over the years. And a lot of people, a lot of actors say this when they go to Star Trek conventions, like Connor Trinneer says it a lot, where it's like, he gets people coming up and saying, you inspired me to be an engineer. LeVar Burton did it as well. People were inspired by LeVar Burton to become an engineer. Same with Gates McFadden, inspired to become a doctor because of Dr. Crusher.
Have you heard that story when she went to Hawaii?
No.
So I think she had a burst appendix. Oh. And there's only one doctor on the entire island that can deal with it. And the doctor walked in and went, Dr. Crusher. And she went, okay, I know I'm going to be fine. that was on The View. She did mm-hmm. that interview with on The View last year for Picard. Yeah, mm-hmm. it was in that. If you need to go and find it, it's brilliant. But yeah, that pretty much sums it up.
Yeah, for me, they are very much an extension of family, more than anything.
Michael, what would your second choice be for the island?
Well, sure. My second choice would be the Star Trek First Contact soundtrack. let me explain.
Wait a second. Is the third choice going to be the audiobook of Star Trek First Contact novelization, and then the fourth choice being the novelization itself?
This entire episode is brought to you by Star Trek First Contact.
Star Trek Legacy now. It was Star Trek, going all the way back to the original series, Star Trek had iconic music. We cannot, under any circumstance, forget. In pop culture, that is like as instilled as the Batman theme from the 60s. It's just one of the, whenever there's fight music, that's what you play. We had all the way through the six movies, we had iconic theme tunes. We had Star Trek Generations, which again is one of my most favorite theme tunes. But then we get Star Trek First Contact. And then we get Jerry Goldsmith, who, have you guys ever seen that meme where it's John Williams getting the task of scoring Duel of Fates, and then it's John Williams' face tacked onto Danny DeVito's head from It's Always Sunny, and it just goes, so anyway, I started composing. and then it's just John Williams on it, like on a piano that's on fire. That, for me, was Jerry Goldsmith with Star Trek First Contact, because he was like, okay, right, that's it. I'm going to finish this martini and I'm just going to write pure gold. It shows how good it is when Terry Metalis was like, no new theme tune, that for season 3 of Picard. When I first saw the end credits for season 3 of Picard, I thought, that's a fan film. That's fan made. That no way is that on season 3 of Picard. They would have had their own composer. Nope. Star Trek First Contact. And I got really tearful because it's such an emotional, the intro is such an emotional theme tune, but all the way through the music, the way the Borg's music is done is so referential to the motion picture where we first see V'ger, where we've got that heavy bass twang.
It's also that metallic, almost spring noise, isn't it? When the they also did it for the I think they used it for the Shrike as well, didn't they? It's that kind of.
It was very First Contact all the way through. Yeah, it was. But
whatever that instrument is, I want one.
But not even the orchestral, like the music that they use. I mean, Roy Orbison's Ooby Dooby for Zephyrin Cochrane absolutely pisses a fart in a bar, you know, and it's just like that blended together with Marina Sirtis being drunk as a fart, like, thud. That, and then just Cochrane just like just doing that. And he just like, yeah, you know, if you've got Roy Orbison on the jukebox and you've had a few much tequila, yeah, you would do the same. But even then, my most favourite part, the launch of the Phoenix, where you get Steppenwolf's magic carpet ride. I want to know who thought that was the best song for that. You see it a lot in trailers and stuff like that. I always want to thank the person who thought that is the best song for that trailer. That is the best song for that sequence in a film, because they just nail it. The certain trailer for a certain very popular video game that has now been stuck in my head for so very long and I cannot get it out. Tom Petty. But yeah, the Steppenwolf as the Phoenix is launching Magic Carpet Ride, that it's brilliant. It's absolutely fantastic. And then right at the end, because obviously the theme is played throughout in whatever formation, but then right at the end when you get the classical TNG theme tune mixed with that, absolutely beautiful. And it's one of those, if I'm feeling I need to concentrate or I'm feeling emotional, that is the soundtrack I will put on, because it calms me.
Of the Jerry Goldsmith then pieces in the movie, which is your favorite?
The intro, without a doubt. Without the Star Trek Next Generation accompaniment, yeah, the intro, how it just, it blends, like, so you get this beautiful orchestral piece and then it peeks out to the open where you're on the Borg cube and it just goes in. So it's like, oh, we've got all these hopes and dreams. It's all wonderful and all fluffy and we're in a cube and it's H.R. Giger's Wet Dream. Okay. And then we get the drill, but we're not talking about the drill. So it the way it just bleeds in, it's absolutely beautiful. But for me, that, I mean, everything about that opening is perfect. The intro is subtle. It's just the credits blurring, focusing, and then fizzling out. It's perfect. And for me, the first, I shouldn't really be saying this, when I first got a PC many moons ago, and obviously you don't want to pay for stuff.
LimeWire. Although it's back. Have you seen it's back? As a cryptocurrency. What?
Oh, wow. Okay. Free infection coins. But yeah, that was the first thing I downloaded, was the First Contact album. I bought it later on, guys, so it's perfectly fine. But that was the first thing I bought, because I wanted to experience that whole album. And it was just, yeah, it still gets me to this day. And when I heard it in season 3 of Picard, cried.
Can I just say, on that note, when Stephen Barton and Freddie Wideman had a phenomenal job at that score, just on that note.
The level of credits, commitment.
It's just slightly retimed.
Yeah.
But it's just,
The level of commitment they put into it, because I saw your guys' interview into that, and the level of commitment they put into that, the passion and the dedication, I was like, these need to be full-time on Star Trek, because Star Trek is all about the background people being passionate and dedicated, because they are themselves Star Trek fans, and that love pours through in season 3.
Yeah, exactly. So, who is your favourite character?
My favourite character? Well, thank you very much for mentioning that, Mike, number one. in all of Star Trek, shall we say?
Yeah, let's go all of Star Trek.
Ooh, it's going to have to be Benjamin Sisko. Benjamin Sisko, closely followed by Trip Tucker, because he's got frosted tips. But the frosted the curtains, early, guys.
The early 2000s have a lot to answer for in terms of hairstyles, don't they?
Yes.
I don't know what you mean, Shaw, as he brushes his curtains.
I mean, do you not remember like the twisted spikes and then you used to, you know, colour the ends, yeah.
I never did that. My hairstyle hasn't changed, Mike, since I was like, I'd say. No,
neither has mine. Mine has literally stayed about this for as long as I can remember.
I'm always 20 years too late to the party, but I'm just going to go.
You're still stuck in back. The 90s.
Yeah, it's coming.
Very boy zone.
Wow, okay. chills down. no, so it's wow. We're in Vegas at the same time, Mike. Be very careful.
Are you worried?
I'll frost your tips. No, but it is. It's Benjamin Sisko. For me, hands down, my most favourite captain of all of Star Trek. His character development all the way through. From this, you know, loving and protective father and commander to this badass captain of a space station and a starship who is willing to do anything to get the job done, morally questionable things to get the job done. When we see him argue with his conscience about bringing the Romulans into the war, and he's like, can I live with it? Yes, I think I can live with it. Computer, delete log. You know, we see the transition from this person who has wrestled with moral ambiguity all the way through, and he's like, no, this is war. I need to do this. Yeah. The best characters are always the characters that are not black and white, they are grey in whatever they do. Commander/Admiral Adama from Battlestar Galactica, he was willing to do what he needed to get the job done. Benjamin Sisko, for me, it's more Avery Brooks's performance all the way through, because he's hands down an incredible actor that deserved way more recognition than he got in the time for his portrayal of Sisko. The rise of Netflix has meant DS9 has become more popular now possibly than ever before, and people are taking note of it. But his performance in an episode which I have mentioned on my list, and we'll get into later on, is outstanding. But all the way through, he could be humorous, he could be menacing, he could be emotional, he could bring out a range of emotions within someone that no other captain, not even Kirk, Picard, or anyone like that, has ever done. He was incredible. And I really wish that circumstances were different and we had more Sisko, because I absolutely love him. I
think without Whit Sisko, to your point in terms of, say, they've dealt with his pain quite, you know, directly in the show, like in terms of not just the loss of his wife, but in terms of being betrayed by people that he would have trusted over the years. Like, you think of Cal Hudson in The Maquis, Michael Eddington, Admiral Layton, and say even Cassidy Yates. And it was they were willing to kind of show that and show him kind of dealing with that as best, or in the case of Michael Eddington, not as best as he possibly could.
That was very Moby Dick. Man. Yeah. it was very Captain Sisko hunting his white whale when it came to that. But the Dominion War brought a change within Sisko and to the Sisko character, where, yeah, he was morally grey and he would do anything to succeed in whatever it needed to be done. And I could never, possibly, but I could never see Picard doing that. I could never see Kirk doing that to a certain extent. Sisko was the man who could get the job done. He was the fixer of Starfleet. You know, he was an engineer. Well, not an engineer, but he was a ship designer. And he's like, I have got this and we can do this. And it's like, this shows how badass he is. He designs a ship that is so powerful it can tear itself apart. That is just... he got the mechanic thumbs up from me, where it's just like, you put a big engine in it and just see how it goes. It's very, but his passion and his raw determination to get the job done, it's beautiful. But he also had a playful side. He had a humorous side in him as well. And when we see where they tried to take Vic's casino back, try win Vic's casino, and he's in a tux, and it's just, I absolutely love it. I can't praise Sisko enough, and I can't praise Avery Brooks enough. And I was fortunate to see him at Destination Trek in 2012, one of the last conventions he did. And he is a very polite, calm, well-mannered person who had the time for anyone. But obviously Avery Brooks, he's shied away from the limelight and he's got other causes to pursue. And I admire that, and more power to him.
Yep. No, fair enough. What is your third choice?
My third choice, Mike, number one, the Next Generation two-parter, Chain of Command.
Interesting. Why?
We see a completely different side to Jean-Luc Picard. We see a broken human being. Because up until this point, we have seen a mostly stoic, hard up, very, you know, Picard maneuver man who doesn't take doo-doo from anyone, shall we say, to put it politely.
Yep.
We know he's got a troubled past. We don't know how much. Obviously, we see it in the Stargazer and everything like that. But at this point, we see this man who has survived the Borg, barely, and survived many other things, be broken nearly through torture. And I think this was very brave of Star Trek to do this at the time that it was aired, to show, well, not show, but like portray torture.
Yep.
And how, you know, the Cardassians are willing to push Picard to breaking point, to the, you know, to death, to get what they want. And I think the one thing I love the most about it is you see him all the way through parts one and two. He doesn't break. He doesn't break. He is. There are four, like right at the end when he is liberated and he is sent back to the Enterprise, and he shouts, "There are four lights." And then he sits down with Troy in the ready room and he goes, "They made me believe there was five lights. And I was so close to actually saying there are five lights." And I think it's terrifying to think, holy cow, a man as strong as Jean-Luc Picard was broken and was willing to give up.
Yeah.
And to confess and to basically say there are five lights. They broke him that much. No one is fallible, no one is safe if Jean-Luc Picard can fall. I loved the development of the Cardassians in this. We had, was it David Warner? I believe it was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
David Warner. We had David Warner playing a truly cold Cardassian. The scene with his daughter.
Yeah.
Is just, because the way it's shot, where it's just like you see him playing with his daughter and they're all having fun, and then just Picard's just sat there broken in this like soiled overall. And they are just talking about Jean-Luc as if he is an animal, you know, as if he is an undomesticated pet.
Yep.
And it's just like, holy shit. Like, you see all the way through where they go on about the Cardassian War and how the Cardassians were brutal and stuff like that. But this is where you actually see how brutal they are in the way that they treat their prisoners.
And I have to ask Michael, just as a bit of an aside, but still to do the same episode. Mike, I'm actually, Mike 1 and Mike 2, I'm going to ask you both this, actually. Looking at it as you're older and you've kind of, you know, worked in kind of offices and jobs and all that kind of thing, do you think Jellicoe was completely out of line with his requests for the Enterprise, and was Riker right or was Riker wrong to be a bit of a dick towards him?
Can I go first?
Go for it.
Yes.
Jellicoe was right. Controversial as it is. While you think. So I've been in a position of management, and I know that sometimes the middle management, shall we say, get a hell of a lot of crap from up above.
Yeah.
And they shield as heavily as they can their team below them from that storm, okay? So I know the attitude that Jellicoe was given was because he knows the crap he's getting from up above. He knows what is potentially coming, and he is wanting to get this crew. He doesn't want to work them to death. He wants to get them battle ready, battle hardened, and make them prepare for the worst, which Upon review, when you see it when you're younger, you're like, oh, he's a bit of a knobbin. But then when you look back at it and you go, he's a bit of a knob, but the knob's sort of got a point. He could have done it a little bit better. It could have been a little bit more, you know, nice language. But that is how Jellicoe is a military man. We've got all...
So for me, I'm going to say that he was in the wrong.
Ooh, do explain.
Well, look, I mean, any manager will know this. If you go into a new team, the last thing you want to do out of the gate is essentially sit there and turn it on its head.
Yeah.
Which is essentially what he does. He just goes in there, very bullish. I want it this way. Regardless of the fact there's 1,000 people on a starship that have all worked together for years that know the that know the ship and know each other's strengths and weaknesses better than he does, I think that Riker wasn't right.
But do you feel that Riker could have approached the situation a 100%. Little bit better? Yeah.
100%. Yeah. Riker was still a dick about it.
Yeah.
At the same time, I can also see why Riker did it the way that he did it. I'm not being funny. If I mean, I've been there and I've had new managers come in and they are arseholes and they don't want to give anyone the time of day. I have fought back.
Yeah.
Fair. I've done exactly what Riker has done, to be honest, in the past.
I've been on both sides. And it's interesting.
You know, I just think that Jellicoe was a dick about it. Yes, and I think, to be fair, Riker gave it back as good as he got it.
Yep.
I do have to say, though, that Captain Goodwill did ask his question, and it's very kind of like, if you're watching a HR training video and it kind of showed a quick scene chain of command that says, do you think Riker handled this situation?
Press A on your keypad now.
Either way, you're wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Before we move on to the next question, I'm just going to quickly say Jellicoe was totally right. Anyway, question four. Captain Goodwill, what is your favorite series? I suspect I have an idea what the answer is, but which is your favorite series?
Oh, what is my favorite series? It's Discovery. No, it's...
Season 3 Discovery, no less, as well.
Why? Sorry. I've just caused the burn.
Could be worse. It could be Enterprise.
Well, Michael number one, I was about to say Enterprise, but it's a toss-up because I love Enterprise passionately, and I will die on the hill defending it to this day. Apart from these other Voyages, because that doesn't exist, but I will die on the hill on the Enterprise series and the theme tune. Anyone who poo-poos on that, come and speak to me.
Series is great. Theme tune sucks. I'm sorry.
Season 1 and 2. Mwah. Season 3, get away with a tambourine. I don't want a tambourine and a heavy bass line, okay? Keep the funky track to Star Wars holiday specials, okay? That's fine. Deep Space Nine, for me, is the best Star Trek series ever made. There has been some extremely close contenders of late, but in terms of a season 1 to 7 package, DS9. We in the Nerdy Up North group, we have a Discord channel. And when we started Trekking Up North, we created another channel called Trekking Up North. So whenever we discuss something, people can come and discuss and stuff. And we've had a few people get into Star Trek. And they've said, so we really want to watch Star Trek, but it's very intimidating. It's like, it's very much like One Piece, where it's like, I want to start One Piece. Okay, see you in 7 years. It's like, they're like, where do I start? Do I start with the original series? Do I start with, and we always say the original series, yes, it's good, but it is problematic and it's very 1960s.
Yes.
So you have to approach the original series with 1960s sensibilities. What we do recommend is watch from the Next Generation onwards, and then when you do want to watch the original series and then the 6 movies. When people get to Deep Space Nine, we have always said the same thing. Watch the entirety of Deep Space Nine and then come back to us and tell us how much it has changed your life. Because it never got the... I mean, it was revered by certain Trekkies at the time, but it's only just now in the last 10 years got the full appreciation for how ahead of its time it was, how well it dealt with difficult subjects, amputation from military battle, post-traumatic stress disorder, the as we discussed with Sisko, the moralities of war. And everyone who watches it comes back and goes, holy shit, this was on in the 90s. How did I miss this? How did I? And we're like, yeah, exactly. Like, it was very underappreciated. Like, at the time, even Paramount were like, oh, we've got Voyager, it's fine. And, you know, no one really cared. So they got away with a load of stuff under the radar where Paramount didn't really give a crap. Yep. But it just, it has everything. It has humor, drama, suspense, amazing space battles, lots and lots of ships. And it has
lots of that... the same ship as well, just saying.
No. It has kit bashes, it's fine. And it felt like a family, and it just, only that Star Trek series could take MASH, Cheers, loads of terrifying war movies, and just blend them into one. We had Morn, which is a reverse of Norm. That's all you have to say. This is just the 4077 with Sam at the bar, Norm at the bar side, and then the occasional genocidal battle going off in the distance. And let's not forget, the icing on top of this fantastic cake, Gul Dukat.
Yeah.
The best Star Trek villain ever. Because that man was terrifying, and he was terrifying for one reason. He believed in whatever he was doing.
Yeah.
And he believed it was right.
And he was more terrifying without the moustache.
That was a Lemmy phase. It's fine. They just discovered Motorhead in the Cardassian Union. So it was a phase, but it's gone now.
Michael, that was an incredibly in-depth answer in terms of your favourite series. So we're going to jump straight into what is your fourth choice for the island?
The Next Generation episode, Darmak. Darmak and Jalad Tanagra.
Shatrak. I think that's it. That's it.
When the walls fell. This, for me, and many Star Trek episodes have tried to do it, and many other episodes of other shows have tried to replicate it before and never really done it justice. This is pure Star Trek. This is two people stranded on a planet, no universal translators, no way to communicate. They have to adapt and understand each other. They originally think they are enemies, and through all the way through the episode, this is the exploration of alien languages. This is the exploration of two races coming together to work and, you know, work for a common goal. This is, I love it. I love it so much because this for me is pure Star Trek. It's not, yes, it's not space exploration, but it is the exploration of an alien race, and that alien race exploring the human race and getting to know each other and building a common ground and adapting and understanding each other at a very basic fundamental level. And to see that all the way, I mean, even it's purely, it's one of the memes of Star Trek. It is, there is t-shirts out there, you know, Darmak and Tanad as a beer, you know, Chakra, the walls. It's all memes now. And let's not forget the Picard jacket.
Yep.
The cosplayer's dream, the Picard with the leather shoulder pads, because it was after the 80s, has moved on. It was leather shoulder pads now. But it's
not Romulan shoulder pads.
No, they're just curtains. This is... I remember seeing them and then looking at the Argus catalogue going, they're the same. Oh, you wily costume department, you cheapskates. But it just shows two people trying to resolve their differences. And it's not... Yes, there's a bit of fighting, but they overcome that. And it's symbolic for the fair way. I don't understand you. You don't understand me. But we don't have to fight. We can work together and unite and, you know, fight for a common goal and figure out what we are both on about together. And I absolutely love it. I know we've got more in Lower Decks, But I do wish we had more live action stuff with this race, because it was just seeing everyone work and understand that, like, oh, this is a race that doesn't communicate like normal language. They use allegories. And I love that. What a beautiful poetic way to communicate. Do you know what I mean? Can you imagine doing this episode where it's just like Mike One, his L car's blinking, and it's just like, what is he on about? Oh, well, he's got L cars at the back of his shot. It's beautiful. It's very
blinky.
Very blinky. Yes, it's very TNG episode at its best, shall we say?
Yeah, I can agree with that one. What moment? Oh wait, no, sorry, skip that. Looking at the wrong side of the list. Let's try this again, shall we?
Mike 2.
Mike 2, what is your favourite movie?
When Mike... people watch this, they won't have a clue, like, that you edited out a certain part where I'm just laughing.
Okay, and... Serious?
No, you have to stay. That has to stay in, Mike.
Right.
What is my favourite movie, Mike One? Star Trek First Contact comes to mind.
Right, let's skip past this really quickly.
Straight off the fifth choice, pretty high.
Yeah.
Straight off the fifth choice, shall we?
Yeah.
Do you want to ask me that?
Mike Two, what is your favourite movie? Right, I'm done. See you later. Bye.
Hang on. I'm the one having martinis. What is wrong? Fifth choice, shall we go for?
I'm ready.
Yes.
Mr. Goodwill.
Yes, Mike One.
What is your favourite Star Trek movie? And it can't be First Contact.
Oh. Not my beloved First Contact. Well, okay. Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
Okay.
Need I say more? It was the final voyage of the original crew, or some of them, shall we say. We had Nick Meyer back.
Yep.
We got possibly the best version of the Enterprise A I have ever seen and ever will see, because that is just beautiful inside and out. And we get Christopher Plummer as General Chang. Only in Star Trek VI could you get a one-eyed, maniacal, bald Klingon quoting Shakespeare as he is firing torpedoes right up your tailpipe. That is pure Star Trek VI. I love this. Obviously, again, this is an allegory for the
Cold War.
Yeah, the Russian-American Cold War.
Yeah.
This is a massive allegory for that. It is brilliantly acted by everyone. No one has a minor role in this. There is some comical elements. There are some heavy elements. We deal with bigotry, racism, everything. We see a dark side to Kirk very early on in the movie, which I agree with Bill Shatner, where they're in a briefing room and Spock is arguing with him. And Kirk says, let them die. Shatner says that shot should have stayed on Kirk, so you could see Kirk realizing what he has just said and instantly regretting it. It's beautiful. It's dark. It's militaristic, which for me, Starfleet is a military organization. Yes, we all love the carpets. I am not saying a word against the carpets. However, the way that they portray, like, the radar on the screens and everything's just worn. This is an old ship. Yes, it was refitted, but it's 20 years old. It's getting worn, and there's dents and scratches and stuff like that. And it just felt like everything was coming to an end, and everything was old, and everyone's going to retire, and the ship's going to retire, and everything like that. And it was. Yeah, I think out of all, The Wrath of Khan gets praised, and I am probably the first one to praise it as well. But for me, The Undiscovered Country is just the pinnacle of the original series, where it deals, it's old war horse, like they say about the Cold War, where the Cold War was changing towards the end. Those 50s and 60s spies were no longer, you know, it was no longer that. It was no longer, oh, Trilby in a trench coat passing things in the dark. It was never that. Times were changing. And you know, the Chancellor of the High Council, Gorkon, when he said to Kirk, you and I are not meant to be in this new world. If we are to, you know, usher in a new era of peace, our generation has to live with it.
Yeah.
And it's reviewing it when you are older and understanding world politics at the time, it's like, holy shit. Like, this is how Star Trek talks about modern situations and does not ram it down your throat, which certain Star Trek episodes and series have done. And it's all been because the writing has not been there to make it as subtle.
Yep.
And this, for me, is, aside from First Contact, is my favourite movie.
So, on that, what is your fifth choice?
My fifth choice is possibly one of my favourite episodes from Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and probably a favourite of quite a few people, Far Beyond the Stars. This is Avery Brooks's finest performance. We see the descent of a man into madness all the way through this episode. The fact that they used the same actors for the holodeck dream slash sequence, as we see, is beautiful. J.G. Herzl, Armin, Renee, and everyone like that, all portraying different people, but you knew who they were. We see Jeffrey Combs without makeup. Jeffrey Combs.
The first, isn't it, I think?
it's the first, Jeffrey. If we don't get a Star Trek Combs, I will be fuming, where it's just an episode of just all Jeffrey Combs characters. Come on. Shran, Liquidator Brunt in the same room. It'd be fantastic.
I have ideas now for Vegas, because he's there, isn't he? Should we cosplay as different Coombs characters and do a photo? Oh,
haven't you realised, Mike? One, we're all Jeffrey Combs.
Well, yes, we are. But anyway.
We all play. It's like Gary Oldman. Everyone plays Gary Oldman, and Gary Oldman plays you. You'll be just going about your business one day, and you'll hear cut, and you'll realise you were Gary Oldman all along. It's again. This is dealing with a sensitive subject in American culture. That was more prevalent in the time that this episode is set in the 50s, 60s, but was still relevant in the 90s and is still relevant today. And tackling it head on. You know, this is a genius writer. He's got this great story about this outpost in the far reaches of the galaxy. No, we can't publish it because you are a different colour to us. And just to see, you know, what Benny Russell has to put up with on a daily basis and just see his eventual descent into insanity, which is for the time followed up in a later episode, is brilliant, because not a lot of shows were doing that at that time. You know, you wouldn't go, oh, you know that character you saw, well, he's here now. What? Why are you carrying on with it? That's fantastic. But then it also left it open-ended. And this is what I love about it. Because that very last shot where you see Sisko in his ready room and you see that reflection and it's Benny Russell and it's left it open for many decades. Is this just all a Benny Russell story? What do you think, guys? Leave a comment below. it's beautifully done, beautifully acted. I miss Nog, Eisenberg, Aaron Eisenberg. Sorry, Eisenberg, my mistake. Yeah, I miss him daily because his performance was brilliant. Michael Dorn as just the big player. You're just a man slut in New York. Why not? It's Michael Dorn. Michael Dorn eating 13 burgers a day at this point during filming because he's a legend. But Avery Brooks' performance. It's just you. If you were going to say to start, you know, if you going to introduce someone and do like, you know, show me an example of good acting in Star Trek, you show them Far Beyond the Stars, because holy shit, it's just, it knocks it out of the park.
Yeah,
And in terms of, say, like DS9 is the only show really that could have pulled off an episode like this, really, isn't it?
Definitely.
The way they do it, yeah.
Michael, question for you then is going to be, what is your favorite episode?
Of Deep Space Nine?
Nope, across all of Star Trek. We never said it was going to be easy.
There are four lights.
No, there are five.
There are four lights. My favorite episode throughout Star Trek. Wow. That is a really tough one. But I'm going to play it safe. It was a 30th anniversary special, The Trouble with Tribbles.
Trials and Tribulations.
Sorry, my mistake.
We knew what you meant.
There are 900 episodes, guys. I'm going to forget.
What, you don't know them all?
No, but give me a ship's registry and I'll tell you the class. we have selective Star Trek memories.
74205.
That's defiant. Come on, guys. Give me something hard. I can't even remember the adequates. Was it 65418 something? Oh, I don't care. But Trials and Tribulations, yeah, because it was so lighthearted, so much fun. It was a crossover that no one suspected at the time. We knew they were doing crossovers because it was the 30th anniversary. We had Voyager's one with Hikaru Sulu, which then spurred off decades of, I want an Excelsior spinoff. And they're like, George Takei is 80 now. Time Vortex. It was like, it was so brilliantly done for 1996. Like the way that they just blended in Chief O'Brien and Sisko, and they were like, oh, we're going to take snippets from this episode and this episode. And to just rebuild the original series Enterprise model from scratch, rebuild K7 from scratch and have them in there, the passion, the dedication into this episode, and just the little one-liners in there where Jadzia Dax is on about the tricorder. I've got to love classic 23rd century design. Where it's just like, yeah, it's piano black. Yeah, nice. And then
your flap open.
Yeah, well, you know, if your flap's open, you're going to drain the battery. The power cells don't last long. So close your flap, Julian. oh, where's Garrick when you need him? But the little nods to like Trek history, where they tackle things head on. And Lower Decks does this brilliantly, where it's just like, they're looking at the Klingons in the bar and they're going, I know what you're thinking. So this, you know, why do the Klingons don't discuss it with outside people? And it's just, do you know what I mean? And then they go on about the Tribbles, and Odo's just like, oh yes, I remember the great Tribble Hunt songs that they sing around the campfires and stuff like that. And it's like, oh, how could you be so afraid of this little thing? And he's just intimidating. Again, someone pissing off Worf for the amusement of everyone else. Yep. But it's so lighthearted, it's so fun, it's so well done. And it then spurs on little things going forward, like Lower Decks, where they're on about Nick Locarno, and it's just like, Ruthless sat there, like, he looks like Tom Paris. No, I don't see it. But they've got the same voice. I'm telling you, he looks like Tom. I don't really see it. But I love the bit where it's Kirk and Spock in the corridor, and Kirk's talking to the bridge, and Jadzia Dax is like, he's so handsome.
And everyone thinks it's Kirk.
And so handsome. And he's like, yeah, Kirk's a bit of a player. Kirk? No, screw Kirk. Spock. And then the way that 30 years later is then doubled down on with Mariner.
Yep.
Going on about, I didn't realise Spock was so hot.
As you're mentioning that, I was just quickly checking it there. It's even more shocking. When Trials and Tribulations came out, Trouble Tribbles was, say, 28 years old. And to make it even more shocking, Trials and Tribulations is 28 years old next year. So if we were to take, say, an episode of Lower Decks made next year that goes back to the episode, it's the same length of time.
I want to go home!
We have reached that age with us now who's kind of saying, I remember that episode that was new. Oh no, wait a second. I'm the old person in the room.
It's so... It's scary, isn't it? Because I vividly remember the 30th anniversary of Star Trek and all the specials and those quiz shows that they were doing on BBC Two at the time. I vividly remember that. And it's like, we're celebrating Star Trek's 30th anniversary. And then we're like, guys, it's the 30th anniversary. Yeah, and it's like they're 57 and this movie is 30 years old and this is 25. And I'm just like, stop, will you please?
I'm so old.
It's scary. I reference this because you guys posted when it was like, it's the 57th anniversary of the airing of The Menagerie, and our Darbo wheel on Trekking Up North span The Menagerie Part 1 on its 57th anniversary. And I'm just like, is this rigged? but it's scary to think, because we've all grown up with this. It's scary to think that these are the same age as the original series, but it shows how well they have held up.
Yeah,
and how ahead of the time the shooting techniques were. Because if you look at the 90s, you had Babylon 5, and they were like, everything's going to be CGI, and it's crap now because it doesn't look nice. Yep. It really doesn't look nice because it was done with what they had at the time, but it was not that good. But then you look at Star Trek, and it's just like the models hold up, the costumes hold up, the lighting, the director, everything still holds up, and it's hard to get around this, like, the next generation is nearly 40 years old.
I know.
And you know, DS9 is 30 years old. They look like they were made 10 years ago or 15 years ago.
But ironically, if you look at TOS now, that has not aged well.
No, but you take it at face value. And you know, this is what you say. If you bring in someone into Star Trek, you can say, yes, you can start with the 60s, but it's 60s sensibility, 60s mindset, and everything is paper mache, because they had a budget of 20 pence to make this show and they made it last. So yeah.
And Michael, with that, what is your sixth choice for the island?
This one is the second only one of two Star Trek episodes that will break me emotionally, and it is Star Trek Enterprise's season 3 episode, Similitude. Holy cow. I have to skip this now during my rewatch because I just can't take it anymore. They deal with the moral quandary about cloning and about how you have to save one life, you have to take one life to save another. The way that this is done all the way through is beautiful. For anyone who doesn't know Similitude, it's in season 3 of Star Trek Enterprise. Trip has an accident. Trip Tucker, Frosted Trips, has an accident. I'm telling you, in Vegas, I'm going to make him the most awkward person there.
He's going to shout out, hey, Frosted Trips.
Trips, tips. remove him. And it's going to be...
we get Jonathan Frakes next to them, and then we've got Frosted Frakes and Frosted Trips.
Frosted Frakes. No, I want him to make cakes and say, Frakes Bakes. So it's the new look thing from Greg's.
Sorry, sidetracked.
Oh, the international viewers are going, what? For anyone who doesn't know, Trip has an accident in engineering and he's put into a coma. And the only way to save his life is they need to clone Trip from his DNA because they need a specific internal body part to save Trip's life. So they need to grow another human in order to harvest that part so Trip lives. The only downside is they can only harvest it when Trip, the clone of Trip, reaches the same age. So they essentially put rapid growth into the clone. Very, very Metal Gear Solid, which I do appreciate as a gamer, but they do rapid growth. So it's over the space of a week. Instead of 20 years or anything like that, it's a week. So we see this newborn baby, this newborn test tube baby, and we see them grow, and we see the crew bond with the child, which is inevitable on a small ship. that the crew are going to bond. They're going to help him with his education and everything like that. And everyone bonds with the child, similar, instead of the captain, who at this point, Archer is very staunch. He's very cold. He's very Sisko in season three, I'd like to say. But he eventually does start to ever so slightly bond with Sim. He shows him the remote control spacecraft that he's carried with it, which, you know, of all the things to bring on a tightly closed thing, let's just bring a drone onto a plane. You know, overhead storage on planes are bad enough. Can you imagine what an NX is going to be like? But then it gets to the point where Sim knows what his destiny is. He knows why he is there, why he was created, and he chooses life. He chooses to... He originally says, well, I can do everything. I've got Trip's memories. I can do everything that Trip can do. Why can't you just have me and let Trip die? And Archer's like, it's not as simple as that. It's not as cut and dry as that. Yes, you've got his memories per se, but you are not Trip, and we need Trip. So he tries to escape in the shuttle pod, doesn't go through it, and we just get this inevitable acceptance of fate. And this is the point that gets me every single time, because the way that the composer for the episode injects the little flute into this, where we are seeing, I mean, I'm getting welled up now just thinking about it, because it's so powerful the way they do it. For Star Trek Enterprise, people crap on Enterprise quite a lot, and I will always say this is one of the episodes you must see, because this shows the true acting range of everyone in this episode, except Connor Trinneer, who's just sat on his ass for most of it getting a paycheck. But it's more the emotion that we see, that this person has to die, and the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few of the one. He needs to be euthanized, shall we say, to save Trip's life. And it gets me every time, because even though it's a 40 odd minute run, you bond with this person, you see them grow up, and to see them volunteer to die to save someone, even Phlox, of all people at this point in thing, because we see it at the end of season four, but even Phlox at this point is broken by it and deeply upset by it. And it just, yeah, it gets to me. And I think this deserved all the awards, and it just made it cemented why I loved Star Trek Enterprise so much, and still do to this day. It is a very underrated show that deserved 7 seasons.
Yep, fair enough. I can't agree more. So, what moment defines Star Trek for you?
What moment defines Star Trek? There are a couple of moments, so I'm going to be cheeky and I'm going to have a couple, if that's no. Okay.
Oh my God, hang on, Mike. We need to check the rule book here.
Have you got the rule book there?
Yeah, who cares about rules? Who cares about rules? There is a couple of moments. Zefran Cochrane shaking hands with the Vulcans for the first time, because for me, that is where Star Trek begins. Yep. And the little dialogue we have between Lily and Picard, where she goes, I envy you the world you are going to. And Picard goes, I envy you taking these first steps into a new frontier.
Yep.
It's beautiful. It is literally the beginning of everything that you love. This is what happened. And then the second moment that defines Star Trek. This is a new one.
Is it the burn in Star Trek Discovery season 3 and how they figure out what it is?
Oh, you know, come on!
How the season finale starts it all out.
No, it's the DMA in Species 10C.
How do you kill trillions of people? Oh, I just scream. No, this is quite... I like Discovery, please don't come at me. This is a recent one, and again, it goes back to that theme of family. It is the closing scenes of season 3 of Picard. No one dies. I mean, spoiler. No one dies. Everyone survives. They're all together, and they are all having fun playing poker, and the camera just spins. Yeah. And the camera just spins on all these people. These are people that have known each other for 30, 40 years, 35 years, 36 years. They love each other and they are together. They are a family. That, for me, is what Star Trek is. It is about family. Yes, it's seeking out new life, new civilizations. And yes, it's all about embracing other cultures, embracing other people. We all know that. That is a philosophy that everyone should live by. That is, for me, Star Trek, obviously I've been a Star Trek fan since I was two. Those values have been instilled in me. They have been baked into my DNA since I was 2 years old. That's a given. But it's family. Because I never had a family. I had a family, but I never had a lot of family. They were the second family. And just to see that moment where it goes, because I don't know about you guys, all the way through that season, I was like, someone's going to die. Someone's going to die and I'm not going to like it. And I'm going to be crying and I can't be bothered to cry on a podcast because I will lose all my cool points. But for them all to survive and to all be there and to all love each other, that is what Star Trek is for me. Star Trek is family, not the Fast and the Furious. Star Trek is family.
Okay. What is your seventh choice?
Well, speaking of, we've just been discussing this. It's Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. If I can take two movies onto this desert island, First Contact lenses and the Undiscovered Country music.
That's going to be a Ferengi movie, yeah?
The birth of the FDA. The Undiscovered Country, because it was action-packed where it needed to be. It was dialogue-heavy where it needed to be. Yeah. The director's cut of the movie is sublime. We get to hear Scotty say the word bitch. And I'm just like, what? I'd seen this movie for decades until I got the director's cut in 2007. And I went, oh, he said bitch. And then I was like, oh, Klingons don't have tear ducts. That's cool. but no, it was a generation's final journey, and it was nailed absolutely brilliantly. And again, it shows that even the most hardened bigots, shall we say, to a lesser extent, can learn to appreciate other cultures and appreciate differences and work with each other for a better tomorrow. Kirk did this all the way through. He didn't want to be the envoy. He did not want to be anywhere near the Klingons. Nope. For understandable reasons, they killed his son. I would be the same. If someone said, oh, you know those dudes that killed you? So, yeah. Would you mind just escorting them over? No, absolutely not. I would rather shovel the septic tank than do that. He did it. He didn't want to, but he did it because he is a Starfleet captain. That is his order. Yes, at the beginning of the movie, he's just like, let's just get it over with. Let's just get it over. He even says that on the bridge. Right, let's just get this over with. Yep. Does the dinner, does everything. But at the end, he learns that it's not about him. It is not about his prejudices. It's not about his beliefs. It is about the greater good. And if the greater good means he has to work with people he doesn't like, he will do it. Going back to the office talk about managers, if you sometimes have to do stuff you don't like, but that is your job. That is your duty because it is for the greater good. So for me, my seventh choice, Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. For what I said previously, the acting, the direction, the visual effects, the way the Enterprise A is portrayed is goddamn beautiful. We have got digital clocks on view screens, people, and it is constantly continuity perfect all the way through.
Yep.
And then we get books with Uhura trying to speak Klingon. And I love the bit where she's like, they're trying to pass the security check. And she's like, I'm not going to butcher Klingon. But they're like, oh, we are transporting this to Krodos, the Klingon homeworld. And the outpost is like, don't catch any rats. Aha, aha. And then she's like, what do I do? And the woman's just like, you stuff. She's like, aha. And I love that. It's just beautiful from Michelle Nichols. Because you know, by this point, she can't be asked. She's a communications officer. She's done this for decades. She's just, oh, just... can get on with it, let's just get it done. But everyone's performance and everyone's prejudices do come out in that. Obviously we get Kim Cattrall, but we get everyone's prejudices, even Spock's to a certain degree. We get the amazing trial. We get Worf is some sort of Worf that never really gets into it, but we get Worf, the Klingon trial, which is amazing. And then we get to see, like, holy shit, a very terrifying prison that, you know, Rua Penthe, what a brilliant way to show a Klingon prison. Yeah. Where they're just like, oh, if you misbehave, whoosh, straight out into the snow, bye, that's it. So, yeah, Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, mwah, beautiful movie.
Mikey, tell us about your podcast, Trekking Up North.
Oh, God, it is an awful show. No one should ever listen to it. It's absolutely rubbish. Trekking Up North, it's a really weird one. Trekking Up North is part of Nerdy Up North. We are a huge Facebook group in the northeast of England. We celebrate everything nerdy, no matter what it is. It could be sci-fi, it could be books, it could be Lord of the Rings, it could be anything that you love. Even if it's not considered nerdy, we will celebrate it because you nerd out about it. We have a general podcast where we discuss everything you can think of. We've reviewed movies, we've talked about film franchises, actors, jump the shark moments, which... there's been a few in Star Trek, let's admit. And then...
like season 3 of Discovery, the final episode, yeah.
Science Officer Sinoise is currently going through season 3 of Discovery, and I get very long voice recordings, which are just basic reviews of the last 40 minutes of his life. And I'm just sat there in the office going, mm-hmm. But no, so we have the general podcast, and we were the first spin-off podcast when season 3 of Picard came out, because I proposed the idea. I was like, I want to do something about Star Trek, because I was a guest on one of their shows before I was brought onto the team. They loved my passion for Star Trek. They loved what I've dubbed the Wall of Bankruptcy, which is just literally half a room of Star Trek starships, or as I call my Wall of Bankruptcy, that's slowly migrating into the rest of the house. So I started it with my lovely co-host, Graham, or as he is called on the show, Science Officer Sinoise, who is a Geesian from the planet Honk, because you have to have a ridiculous alien race. We've got Dr. Migliamu, and Graham now just constantly says, you don't have to throw up in my mouth twice. So I am Captain Goodwill of the USS Adequate, the most rundown starship in all of Starfleet. It's a knackered old Akira-class starship that Mike number one has kindly done a little commemorative commission plaque where he's just like, you get to take charge of a ship, bring some duct tape. So we beam down every week, or we have done before our Christmas break. We beam down every week. We reviewed every latest Star Trek episode that came out, no matter what the series was. And then we do the dabble wheel of episodes and movies where we will spin that every week, and whatever it lands on, we must review it for next week. We've done well so far. So we've had some pretty solid episodes. It was just weird when we landed on the Menagerie. And then as soon as I looked at the Clone Star, I was like, oh, on this day, 57 years ago. And I'm like, But it's a lot of fun. It's two northern nerds from the northeast of England celebrating what we love about Star Trek, reviewing Star Trek episodes, and encouraging people to get into Star Trek, because this is a franchise that needs to be celebrated now more than ever for what it represents, for the values that it brings. And I am so happy that we have been able to bring new people into the fold and let them share in our passion of Star Trek. We do Interviews, not at the same level as Clone Star Podcast, I may add. Lovely alert. But we do, we've interviewed Lovely Mike One. We've had Joseph on the charity stream. You guys will be coming back. It's non-optional. You don't have a choice. Don't make me get the gun. It was, we have fun. We just want to share our love of Star Trek, and the community that we have found on social media doing this show has been wonderful. It has been heartwarming to meet the likes of yourselves, the likes of that little weirdo called Sean from Trek Culture. It's been absolutely, it's been wonderful. And what's scary is that international people take notice. And they're like, your accent is sexy. And I'm like, you need medical attention pretty quickly. It has been so much fun. And I'm looking forward to the next year. I have been busy away formatting certain things because we have got a very large gap of no Star Trek for a while. So I'm looking to zhuzh it up. We'll be reviewing one movie a month, starting with the motion picture. And doing random episodes and doing a holiday episode of Star Trek where we will take a Ryzen episode. I will adorn the background of mild bankruptcy with lots of tropical adornment. I will wear one of my 17 million Hawaiian shirts. We will have a martini and we will get drunk talking about a Ryzen episode of Star Trek, of which there are many. Not necessarily Ryzen, but any holiday-centric episodes. This all started with Captain's Holiday, where me, Sanoise and Mark Cartier from the Shuttle Pod Show basically deduced that Captain's Holiday was a failed porno. So, and the realization on my face is like, holy crap, it actually is. It comes out on Trump, but it's huge amount of fun. I love everyone who I have met. I love you guys, and long may it last.
So, Michael, the last question we have then for you, well, there's your choices, is what's your eighth and final choice?
The original series episode, The Balance of Terror. What an amazing episode this is from the original series. If you're going to say to someone, give me a couple of episodes to watch from the original series if I'm not going to watch all of them. Because Star Trek, the original series, has always been famously 79 episodes, 30 good ones. Balance of Terror is up there for me because it is just, it's Master and Commander. It's that standoff. It is that two brilliant military tacticians duking it out. Yes, there's a bit of a space battle, but it's just not all out pew, pew, pew all the time. There's mythology. It's methodically done. There's tactical decisions to be made. They deal with bigotry, racism head on. We get to see the Romulans for the first time. And the Romulans suspiciously look like Vulcans, and totally not because it was the 1960s and they had a budget of 20p. They use that to their advantage, which is what the original series did quite well. Yep. Where they're just like, they've got pointy ears, Spock's got pointy ears. Is Spock a secret Romulan? Is he a spy? And you get that where the con officer says, you know, my grandfather served in the Earth-Romulan War and he died and he's got prejudice against the Romulans. So as soon as he goes, oh, them be him. So him must be bad. And how Kirk just deals with that head on. And he goes, you leave your bigotry in your quarters when you are on duty. And I love, for the 1960s, yes, Star Trek is problematic, but for the 1960s to say that, absolutely spot on. We get to see the beautiful Romulan bird of prey, which is gorgeous. And then we get Mark Leonard as not Spock's dad, which as a young kid is very confusing because you're just like, he died in season one. What? Hollywood reused actors, son. This is like Taggart in Scotland. Oh, okay, right. Seven different murderers, yeah. So Mark Leonard's performance. And I love that little scene just at the end where it's just like, in a different universe, we could have been friends, you and I. But the way, like, the Romulan commander chooses his own fate and chooses, you know, this is the way. I am a warrior. This is how I must go out. I cannot be captured. I cannot be taken safely. I must end it the Romulan way, the noble way. And he chooses self-destruction over preservation. And just the whole way it's done. And even at the wedding, right at the beginning, and how they deal with the B plot of what, you know, the fallout of that. It's, I love it. And it is just such an example of a good Star Trek episode. And hell, even the season one finale of Strange New Worlds, gotta admit, they hit it pretty close to the nail on the head from that. Even the little visual, you know, the little light strip along the eyes and Spock's eyebrow, could have done without the ting when he did it, but just that and the music and, oh, absolutely beautiful. An iconic Star Trek original series episode up there for me. That is my eighth choice.
And Mike, we have a few last questions that we're going to run through quickly with you, but one that we haven't told you we're going to ask because we're awful human beings. You've given us a list of eight, but if something went wrong on the island and you could only save one, and without a justification, which one are you going to go for? You can only pick one.
Only pick one?
Yeah.
Only pick one of your eight.
Star Trek First Contact. Next question. For me, Star Trek, we go on about a lot how some of New Trek is a gateway.
Yep.
To old Star Trek. If we didn't have New Trek and people were looking for a gateway, I would point them directly at Star Trek First Contact. Not Enterprise or anything like that. I would say start with that because that is literally the beginning of the Star Trek universe. Yep. That is that. Without that, none of this would have existed. First Contact would have been made. Star Trek First Contact. If I could have one movie, Star Trek First Contact, one bit of Star Trek at all, First Contact, because it had everything. Battles, music, excellent dialogue, Roy Orbison, a drunk alcoholic breaking the light speed barrier. Thumbs up for me. The one thing.
So just a few last questions then we have for you, Michael. If we're, as we're about to send you off to the desert island and taking our cue from the greatest man living, Nicholas Meyer, we're going to send you off with the collected works of Shakespeare and Sherlock Holmes, but you can pick one book to bring with you as well. What book is it?
Leviathan Wakes. I am a huge fan of the TV series The Expanse. I think it is up there in my top five sci-fi shows of all time. It's the most accurately depicted version of space travel that has ever been produced. You know, this is humans 300 years in the future. This is how they will literally do it. This is what they will literally have to go through to achieve that. These are the hideous deformations people in the asteroid belt will have because of gravity. It is perfect. And I wish there was more of it. And hopefully, fingers crossed, there will be spin-offs. Leviathan Wakes is the book that The Expanse is based on. And like most books, there is more detail within the book than there is in the TV show.
Shock.
Shock horror. I literally have 4 hours spare a year to do what I want, and I cheekily decide to play video games. But I would love to sit, when I eventually do start to have more spare time, I would love to sit with the first book, Leviathan Wakes, and just go through this universe. Because it's a rich universe, and it's very much, if anyone's ever never seen The Expanse and you enjoy rich world-building universes, this is one of them. This is like, they throw you so hard into the deep end with this that you just have to go along with it and you learn along the way. It's just like, oh yeah, it's the 2300s and humans have done this. Okay, bye, we're off. And then it just goes into this murder drama. And you're like, what, wait, what, eh? He's got a fedora, but he's on an asteroid and what, eh? And a lot of people, when they read it, when they watch it, they're like, I don't get it, why is it? And it's like, you have to watch it because you learn about the world. The world teaches you as you watch. And I want to read the book to experience that in so much greater detail. Because one thing I love, and this is why I love Battlestar Galactica and Stargate and everything like that, it's the world they build that you can just get lost in. And if I can get lost in one good book, Leviathan Wakes will be that.
And what luxury item would you take with you?
Martini. There you go.
No. That's not a luxury item. That's a vice. It would be... If I can't have one with the other, it would just be a TV to watch Star Trek on. It would have to be a TV. If I could have a TV and a games console, it would be a TV to watch Star Trek and then play Star Trek on the lineup. But it would have to be a TV, because I'm like, the beauty of Star Trek is, like we joked earlier on, there are nearly or just over 900 episodes and the 13, 14 movies. You could watch all of them like from the beginning, chronological order, all the way through, start again and not realize what the is going on, because you've just digested 900 episodes. So it's great, because your brain cannot retain so much information from 900. That's why I got the episode title wrong, guys. Your brain cannot retain so much level of detail from 900 episodes and X amount of movies. So it's a great cycle watch. It's great to just, I've finished that now, I'm going to start again. Oh, I forgot about that. So for me, TV to watch Star Trek.
And how would you handle the isolation? Are you good in your own company, basically?
Yes, I'm living alone at the moment. And I love it. I handle it really well. Ironically, I will have Star Trek on in the background most days as I work, either Star Trek or, not a lot of people know it, Mystery Science Theatre 3000.
Yeah.
I will have that. If I'm feeling rather lonely, I will have that on as I sleep, because, again, it's a comfort. Same with Star Trek. You just let it go on play and then just play. Yep. Have it on the TV as you work. Turn around and go, oh, Janeway's drinking coffee. Oh, Janeway's killing another... Oh, right. Okay. Right. So she's murdering again. Is she brilliant? And then you turn around. She's like, oh, Tuvix. Oh, never mind, Tuvix. So it's handling that isolation. I wouldn't feel isolated because my second family is there.
Yeah.
My Star Trek family is there. So I will never feel alone.
And how resourceful are you to live on your own in a desert island?
I will die within 3 days. But what a 3 days it will be when I'm going through Star Trek. Will I die during season 2 of DS9 or season 7 of Voyager? Wait and see. I can successfully live on my own. On a desert island, I'm allergic to coconuts, so that could be quite... problematic.
That one is an island free of coconuts.
But is it free of bounty bars? So, I would give it the old college try. I would be Starfleet, because I do have the Starfleet Survival Guide that was published in 2002, where it's just like, in the event you are merged with another crew member, this is what you do. And you're just like, wow, it doesn't say murder. So, okay. But it's like, how to adapt a tricorder for this. But it's like, how to know that this plant is going to paralyze you from the neck down and stuff like that. And it's like, it's daft and it'll never be real. But I've got a survival guide, damn it, and I will take its methodologies and principles with me for those 3 days before I die of thirst, because it's all coconuts.
So, the final and last question. It's going to be super easy. Doesn't take any thinking whatsoever. Michael Adam Goodwill.
Oh, God.
What does Star Trek mean to you?
Star Trek is love. Star Trek is life. Star Trek means everything to me. Without Star Trek, I wouldn't be the person I am today, an anxiety-riddled mess of a martini drinker who wears Hawaiian shirts to make himself feel comfortable. It has been there... at my very lowest points in my life. It has been there at the very highest points of my life. I have, in the last year, I would say, I have gained a whole new appreciation for Star Trek, which I thought never possible. I have met friends, wonderful people, through my love of Star Trek. I have met you guys through my love of Star Trek. I have encountered wonderful people all over the world who share my passion. We get a bad rap Trekkies and Trekkers and Treksters, or whatever you want to call yourself, we get a bad rap for being very toxic. And I will not deny there is an element that is literally needs to be put in a concrete bunker somewhere, because, wow, they are toxic. But every fan base has them.
Yep.
All you have to do is go block or ignore. You, if you don't interact with them, they don't interact with you. It's pretty straightforward to find people on the same wavelength as you, people who share your love and are not toxic. Star Trek has quite literally saved my life, been there all my life, and has changed my life for the better through doing a mediocre podcast on a Friday night whilst drinking copious amounts of martini with someone who is really political about the current British government. And then we occasionally talk about that week's episode. But for me, I will never stop loving Star Trek. My first ever tattoo, which I'm going to get, will be Star Trek related. Thus is my deep, deep passion of Star Trek. And the life goal, the end goal, the dream would be to work on Star Trek or be in Star Trek in some form or another. I could be the guy that gets Anson Mount his coffee. I could be the dude at the bar on the Enterprise on Strange New Worlds, or some random alien sweeping up rubbish. If I get to do that, my life is completely fulfilled. And I came to that realization in Los Angeles 2 months ago when I was actually at Paramount. And you get to go around the studios and you see stage 8, stage 18, stage 15. And you see the plaques where they go, this is where Star Trek Enterprise was, this is where Voyager was and TNG. And you're there and it's like a pilgrimage.
Yep.
Because you go, this is where my life was formed. This is where my deepest principles, my values, my ethics, this is where who I am was made. And I know people will think it's cliche, you base your values on a TV show, but yeah, because the values and the morals and the ethics that they instilled are well worth having as a human being. To be tolerant of other people's races and cultures, who would not want to be that person? We should strive to be a united species that gets over the challenges of war, poverty, global warming and everything like that, and look forward to the future, look to the stars, because that is humans' destiny. That is where we need to go as a species. And Star Trek is an excellent, excellent bed, an excellent foundation to build your principles, your beliefs, and your civilization from.
Brilliant stuff, Michael. Thank you so much. We'd like to thank Michael Adam Goodwill from Trekking Up North for joining us today for Desert Island Trek. I'd also like to thank my co-host, Mike Overton, as always. Mike, thank you so much. Or Mike 1 and Mike 2, as I will call the both of you going forward. Thank you all very much for listening, for watching, and we will see you again on another episode of the Clone Star Podcast. Thanks very much, guys.